Salta mi jale, jaleya, uy, uy, jule, jaleya.
Welcome to the California Indian Radio Project. This program is Our Heroes Are Often Called Bandits.
Somebody that's honest, straightforward, not lazy, carries things out or follows up to make sure things are done right, not afraid to try something new.
My first hero was Andrew Jackson. Oh, what a I didn't know. Because, you know, in our books in the schools, they never tell us what he had done to the Native people.
As chief, he did what he thought was best for his people, and the court agreed. So they sentenced him guilty on the robbery and murder and executed him the next day. But they did drop the treason charge because he was acting as a chief for the good of his people.
I figure it's their fault, too. Being on our land before we got here.
I think that's about time that we start talking about modern-day heroes instead of the old-time heroes. They did their job, and they're gone. Now we ought to start doing our own.
I'm Joseph Orozco. I'm Hoopa from Northern California. When I was a kid, I had heroes. My dad, Crusader Rabbit, Mickey Mantle. I knew about Jim Thorpe, too. I knew who he was, an Indian like me. In school, I learned about American heroes, George Washington, Andrew Jackson, Lewis and Clark, and, of course, George Armstrong Custer. Catherine Sauble, a Kerwea elder from the Morongo Reservation, had heroes, too.
My first hero was Andrew Jackson. Oh, what a I didn't know. Because, you know, in our books in the schools, they never tell us what he had done to the Native people. It's always that he was a hero, he was a great fighter, this and everything. So I said, oh, he's my hero. And then when I went to the University of Colorado, Boulder, there was a lot of elders that used to come and speak to us. And then they told me about my hero, that he was the one that instigated that removal of the Cherokees, the Trail of Tears. And I said, well, there goes my hero, you know.
I figure it's their fault, too.
Jose Rivera is a Native historian who has dedicated his career to finding our lost heroes and giving them their voices back.
I was at DQU. A good friend of mine that we were hanging around, and we were both involved with the Spiritual Unity Caravans and the Spiritual Unity Conferences. He was half Degueño and half Luiseño. And a whole bunch of us were kind of sitting around a campfire. And we were relaying different heroes and historical characters, and we would talk about Crazy Horse and Tecumseh and Quanah Parker. And then they asked my friend, what was a name of a great leader from his people? And he kind of thought a little while, and he kind of shrugged his shoulders, and he couldn't think of any. That incident really hit home for me because he and I were such good friends, and I've spent many months with he and his father over on the Santa Isabel Reservation. So from that experience, I felt that I wanted to bring out the voice. I wanted to bring out the history of the California Indian people and the leaders that they have. And there's so many Native California leaders from contemporary times to colonial times to Aboriginal times. I mean, every band, every rancheria have people to look up to.
Somebody who has came a long ways, and they had started off with a goal and went towards that goal, and no matter what hills had came upon them, they still strived for that goal. They didn't let it get them down, or they didn't use excuses to finish what they were doing.
Well, I think Antonio Garra, the Copeño from San Diego County, is a really good example. In many ways, I've equated Antonio Garra with Tecumseh because his plan was to also unite different bands and uniting Indian people to fight against a common enemy. And Antonio Garra, at first, actually wanted to live in peace, both with the Spaniards, the Mexicans, and the Americans. So here he was actually making an effort to try and live peacefully with these people. Now, what intrigues me about Garra is, again, he revolts against the United States for the same reasons the Americans revolted against England: taxation without representation and the failure of due process in the judicial system. The county of San Diego were taxing the Cupeño people and basically receiving nothing in return for their taxes, and were definitely not being represented in any fashion. And Garra then took the path. He was forced into the path of the warrior, and he wanted to unite the Chumash, that they call the Tulianos. He wanted to unite the Cahuillas. He wanted to unite the Mojaves. He sent messengers as far down into Mexico even. So he was thinking of the big picture, kind of like the Sitting Bull, of uniting the different tribes together as a fist instead of being broken off one by one, as Sitting Bull uses the example. So Antonio Garra wanted to live in peace, was forced into the path that he took. And what's interesting also is at his trial, and in fact he had a court-martial because there was no American civilian government structure yet in California, so he was given a court-martial. The charges were robbery, murder, and treason. And his lawyer basically said that, how can the United States try him for treason when he made no oath to the United States, and that as chief he did what he thought was best for his people? And the court agreed. So they sentenced him guilty on robbery and murder and executed him the next day.
In 1863, groups of Indian men, women, and children from the Chico area were forced out of the Central Valley and marched by the military over the mountains to the Covelo Reservation. In the summer of 1998, the descendants of those original refugees retraced the route of what's called the Chico to Covelo Trail of Tears. I joined them on that trail. When I asked a Wailaki elder to name one of his heroes, he told me a family story. Fred Downing, better known by the name Coyote.
My dad's uncle, he's an American named Jack French. And his Wailaki name, when it's translated to English, was long hair, plenty hair. But everybody called him Yellow Jacket. Stories that were told to me about him was he was a pretty independent man, because in them days it was kind of hard with a lot of our people going away. My mom's generation going away to boarding schools, and a few of the old ones still stayed in the mountains. And he was one of them, with my grandfather, who stayed in the mountains, and they were all horseback people. But they say that he used to, some people called him a cattle rustler. But he knew that the people who lived down in the valley and the reservation didn't have a lot of food all the time, and so he would be hunting. And he occasionally would take a cow. People run cattle out there, and he would butcher a cow and come in with the pack horses at night, bring in and give meat to the people, and by morning he'd be gone again. And so it was a lot of rumor, but a lot of people liked him because he always took care of the people.
A convicted murderer and cattle thief? Are these good examples of Indian heroes? Like many things, it depends on your point of view. There are some important facts that these stories don't tell. There's no mention of the forced relocation of a multitude of tribes onto reservations or into missions under military supervision. Coyote doesn't mention that the reason Indian people didn't have enough food was often because unscrupulous Indian agents took government provisions and sold them for their own profit. He doesn't mention that the children who left for boarding schools were taken from their parents against their will, and those were the lucky ones who weren't sold into slavery. Tony Serra is an attorney who has learned something of our history through defending Native Americans in the court system.
The history of the Pacific Northwest Indian at the hands of the early settlers. You know, there's no words really to express the maltreatment, the unfairness. You have to realize that the Pacific Northwest Indian, in probably a duration of 50 years, they were genocided. They were killed by, you know, direct assaults and by poisoning, by, you know, massacre, going into camps and taking babies and banging them against trees and killing the old people who couldn't flee. So there's an awful lot of pain and suffering and bitterness and agony. It's much larger than any lawyer can articulate.
Everything we know and do as California Indian people, we do against this backdrop. Fred Downing.
We have to be careful when we talk to our children, though, about these times, because we can't appear bitter or hateful, because we don't want our children to grow up with that kind of bitterness and that kind of hate. We just have good feelings for the old people.
One of the ironies of California Indian history is that no treaties made with us were ever ratified, so we never had all the legal rights that Indians in other states have had. Now we have some of the human rights that we didn't have in the 1870s, but the struggle for our traditional rights continues unabated.
Somebody who's honest, somebody who's upfront, who doesn't beat around the bush, and what I mean honesty is, you know, that they're going to do what they say and say what they mean and follow through with it. To me, that means a lot of quality in a person.
My uncle Raymond Matz was the court case that reaffirmed the fishing rights for the Klamath River Basin tribes.
Sue Maston is the tribal chairwoman for the Yurok tribe, whose lands border the ocean and the Klamath River in Northern California. When I asked her to name a hero, she also told me a family story.
He started it all, and he still is there. He's a fisherman. He lives at the mouth of the river. It was called the Matz versus Arnett, or Five Gill Nets versus Arnett is the name of the case. That's the first time in Indian law that set precedents for Indian country. The case said that all executive order reservations are the same as treaty tribes. So that was the most significant part about the case. That happened in the early 70s. And then right after that, there was a big push because the salmon populations were on a decline. And so the Bureau of Indian Affairs, as our trustee, put a moratorium on the fishery, and that brought on the salmon wars, which affected the people of the lower Klamath River dramatically. It was kind of like a war scene in that there were federal agents on the water with M-16s, and they had full riot gear. They were there to save the salmon, and meanwhile, the trollers are still fishing, the sportsmen are still fishing. It's only us who aren't supposed to be fishing. That's what I came home to. I was living in the Bay Area and hadn't been around. And so, you know, it's kind of like, and the first lesson I learned was not all laws are created justly. Of course, that didn't stop the people from fishing, because that was their right to take fish, and they had done it all their lives, and they continued, but they had to hide and fish in the dark and hide from the fishing game wardens, and they were fearful all the time, and they had to be very quiet, and they had to be very sneaky, and they had to, when they heard the boats coming up the water, pull their nets and hide. But if in your heart, something that is your right, that you have always done and you're entitled to do, it's your inherent right, and you believe that and you know that it's the right thing, then you can't let a law that's an unjust law keep you from doing that. The unfortunate thing is, up and down the coast, all of these people who stepped out there to protect the rights for themselves and for all the people, they were termed as the outlaws. And even my own relations, because their name would show up in the paper, were embarrassed about it. And you would hear people talk about, you know, the outlaws of the family or whatever. And that's not what it was. Those were the people who stepped forward, and they were tagged with that outlaw label because they were protecting a right.
To many, Raymond Matz is a hero for defending traditional rights, but the role came at a personal cost.
You have to imagine all that's pinned up inside of him, having to go through all of that, having people call you an outlaw, being stopped by law enforcement officers all the time, having guns on him and his children, having his wife drug across the sandbar and hauled off to jail. I kind of term it as people who went through the Salmon Wars as a post-war, kind of like, you know, a Vietnam vet or anyone who's in a war situation, how that affects them. Because when I first came home, if you even mentioned a state fishing game or a federal agent, it would immediately get a reaction from anyone who participated, and it was anger, fear, and everything rolled up into one.
An Indian person who challenges the status quo or simply finds himself in the wrong place at the wrong time is likely to be presumed guilty of something. The struggle for equal justice is an ongoing one. In the spring of 1995, a nighttime shootout involving police left two men dead, a Mendocino County Sheriff's Deputy and Acorn Peters, a local Indian man from Covelo. Acorn's companion, Bear Lincoln, was eventually arrested and charged with the murder of the deputy. Bear Lincoln believes that they walked into a deliberately laid police ambush. The Sheriff's Department has steadfastly denied this.
There was M16, shotgun blasts, single shots from, you know, semi-automatic weapons. And Acorn was walking ahead of me about approximately 25 feet. Well, I was thinking about the homicide earlier, what could happen. There was a lot of adrenaline in us. And as soon as we got to the ridge, he was shot down. He was killed. And I was almost killed. I was wearing a hat, and a bullet went right through my hat. That's how close it was. At the same time, he was killed. You know, I mean, there was just bullets just being sprayed everywhere. What I seen happen was there was no reason for it. He wasn't a suspect. Neither one of us were suspects in the crime. We had no warrants for arrest. We weren't on probation or anything. And to see him shot down like that just changed the whole world.
Bear Lincoln became a fugitive for several months. During that time, the Sheriff's Department searched vehicles entering and leaving the reservation and conducted house-to-house searches of Indian homes, reportedly even holding families at gunpoint.
Once I turned myself in 4 months later, that started a whole nother episode of this story, because then I spent 26 months fighting the case in court.
Bear Lincoln's case was tried in the Mendocino County seat of Ukiah, about 50 miles southwest of Covelo. The small town became the center of a media circus for several weeks, thanks to the courtroom presence of Tony Serra, an attorney known for his successful defense of highly political capital cases. This time, the usual open and shut case against an Indian in Mendocino County had a different ending. Like Hudi Khoi, the Karuk Indian Tony Serra had defended in 1971, Bear Lincoln was acquitted of all charges. Tony Serra.
So you have to know the history. At least you have to put on the experts who know the history. The juries must be educated. They must understand what genocide is. They must understand that the genocide continues to today through all of these other forms. We must rid ourselves of the stereotypes and must rid ourselves of the indoctrination. So that's what is the first dimension in getting a fair trial for a Native American.
My name's John Forsyth. I'm Wailakian Konkau. I'm a criminal defense attorney. With regard to what Mr. Serra has achieved in the Bear Lincoln case, I think he's being humble. I believe that for two very bright, shining moments in history, the playing field was leveled. And when it was leveled, and when the jury was allowed to see Native defendants on a level playing field, they knew that those people were innocent. That there has always been an oppressive shoot first, ask questions later policy. It's a cowboy versus Indian situation. And it has been that way since the white men first walked into California and started taking over the resources.
John Forsyth was part of the team that defended Bear Lincoln, and is one of the few but growing number of California Indians who are defending the rights of their people by going to law school. As well as working in the courtroom, John is a contributor to the magazine News from Native California.
I have drafted and written a few articles. They're just very basic primers on criminal procedure, how they apply to the Native defendant or the Native suspect. It was my idea to do that because if you ever get arrested, it is absolutely a time of crisis. And you are brought into an arena where, as a Native, it's pretty foreign to you. With just about anyone, it's a pretty foreign area. It has been my experience that Native people are very much out of their element when communicating with non-Native attorneys. Unless they can find an attorney who, one, has some sort of background with Native people, some sort of affinity with them, and can understand the cultural, social, and political ramifications of being Native and how that applies to each and every case, then I think that the Native defendant is going to be seriously prejudiced by having an attorney who doesn't understand or respect the values.
I think sometimes that white society tries to place labels on Indian people. Here are these Indians, and they're up there, and they're being all loud and saying all these bad things. And it's like, we never say bad things. We speak the truth a lot and say from our heart, and a lot of the bad things have happened. And to us, those are the things that need to be spoken about, is the bad things that have happened, and why they happen, how we can make it better, and how we can heal. And, you know, and we're not bandits for trying to do that.
The quality I always tend to look for is community service. If a person is willing to go out there and serve in any capacity to help the people in their community or where they live or where they conduct their business, to me that's a sign that that's a good person, that's somebody I want to be like. And community service involves many different things, helping homeless people, donating to charities, volunteering when appropriate, or being there in a crisis and offering your services, assistance, or whatever help you can provide. That's what I look for.
So it's like about 14 of us, myself and my kids and their wives and families. That's how many of us moved to Herlong.
Sometimes being a hero isn't a matter of doing something big. It's being there in a crisis. Dorothy Miles is a Maidu from Chester, California, and now living in Herlong, California. Her hero is someone who gave her family help when they really needed it.
I think Jean Lamar had a lot to do, and I talked to her, and she took time out right around a little bit after Christmas, just a few days. She took time out to ride with us clear to Herlong, and she looked one of the guys up out there so he could open the doors and show us the houses. And if it wasn't for her, you know, I don't know what we'd have done. It's she helped us a lot, and she still helps us. So it's like, you know, they're a different tribe from us. They're not even the same tribe as we are, but to help people that need help, it was just a miracle to us.
I like honest people, honest about themselves and what they do. Don't talk bad about anybody or swearing, and like to help kids out and be involved with the youth. And that's where it all starts, with the morals and stuff. When they're preschool size, and being nice with them and playing with them and showing them the right way, the good things in life, and don't show them the bad side, just all good stuff. And we got to be firm with them. And I think that's where a good down to earth person is and lives in a country out here. I think it's a great place to live, and you got to respect the land and your surroundings. That's where you come from, and that's all a good person should be, something like that.
I was referred to Bill Franklin by several different people. I caught up with him at a big time in the Sacramento area. Bill was an athlete in his own youth, but now he spends most of his time sharing his tribal traditions with young people.
I lived in my own Amador County area, and I learned to dance when I was 12 years old. Of course, that's about 70 years ago. Yeah, I've been doing it for about 50 years, rejuvenating our dances and rebuilding our costumes and everything like this. So it's worked out real good for the young generation, and I think it keeps them from keeps them away from drugs, keeps their minds on something different that has been, you know. If they don't do this kind of activity, they're out goofing off. That's the way I look at it. Like in my position, I build a nice big rec hall at my place. I have a little ranch, and we practice there Saturday nights and Sundays, you know. Starting Friday night sometime, we stay all night Saturday night just singing and dancing and teaching these kids how to do this, you know, and teaching our hand games, our guessing games, you know, teaching them all kinds of Indian culture. My idea is to keep them off the streets, you know, keep them going straight. This is one of the things that I wanted to emphasize on the dancers and their people, to keep them going straight. Keep them out of mischief and this kind of thing.
Somebody who wants to be something in life, somebody who is respected, somebody who doesn't go out there and have everybody talk bad about them, but somebody that they can look up to, like, hey, you know, I want to be like that person. You know, they really came a long way. They worked hard for what they do.
We dishonor the opportunity that we have by not learning about our culture, you know, then that kind of makes us a bandit in itself.
Chris Lamar operates a business and has also graduated from law school, but he is best known for being the founder of the Indian rap group Without Reservations.
It's all Indian. We back. It's a war crew with something new. 18 feet, 900 pounds with the sound from the rest.
Who raise their kids to learn about their culture, who honor their elders and try to learn from their elders. Those are the people I feel are heroes. You know, that to me, that's the strongest person, is the person who can stand up and say, no, I am Indian. I'm proud to be Indian. The heroes that we have today are those Native people who raise their kids in a good way.
It doesn't have to be a doctor, it doesn't have to be a lawyer, just somebody who feels good about who they are and what they do. That's who I want my kids to be like.
We are back.
I am Joseph Orozco. Who are your heroes?
Our heroes are often called bandits. This program was written and produced by Joseph Orozco and Roby Cook. Production assistants, David Tripp. Series executive producer is Peggy Berryhill. Project director, Roby Cook. Digital editing and mixing, Neil Harvey. Thanks to Wei Kuei and Without Reservations for the use of their music. The music of Koljidimo appears in our opening theme. This program is a project of Northern California Cultural Communications, with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For the California Indian Radio Project, I'm Neil Harvey.
To order a cassette tape of this program or a resource guide with more information about the people and topics we've covered, call 1-800-461-3991. That's 1-800-461-3991. Or visit our website at flickerfeather.org.
This program is distributed by the American Indian Radio on satellite, a service of Native American Public Telecommunications.